Well, thank you, Greg and team. It's great to sing those songs, words of promise, words of hope. Sometimes I got to admit during the week, I don't always feel that way, but it's good to sing those songs. Are there times in your life where you're tempted to compromise? Maybe you're in college and you're a professor mocks your Christian faith. Maybe it's something about the Bible or the resurrection of Jesus. And the temptation is to remain silent. What do you do? Or maybe you travel for work and you have an attractive coworker and they send you a text asking you to come up to their room for a drink. How do you respond? Or maybe final exams are coming next month and your friend has found a way to cheat. Or maybe you're golfing this summer and you're out with your buddies and it's on the 14th hole and somebody shares a joke and it is a very funny joke, but it's a very racist joke. What do you do? Do you speak up? Do you say anything? Or perhaps you begin a new job and you find out from your coworkers on the sales force that everybody pads their expense account. This is part of what we do here in this organization. And it works because everybody's involved in it. Do you go along with it? These are all examples of temptations to compromise. And we have in the first two chapters of the book of Esther, two main characters, Mordecai and Esther, and they are compromisers. Both have hidden their Jewish identity. Esther has compromised her morals in order to become queen. She's kept her Jewish identity a secret. Mordecai, her older cousin, seemed to initiate this with her, and he does the same. He's risen up in the government ranks, and they both come across as pure Persians, just blending in, nothing distinct about them. Esther could become queen with no one knowing that she's a Jew. There's no concern for the Jewish dietary restrictions, nor a concern for the Torah. In fact, there's no mention of God in the book of Esther. But we begin to see a transformation in their lives in chapter 3. So I invite you to turn with me to Esther chapter 3. Welcome to those of you who are watching online too, and trust that you will connect with us in some way this summer. I'd encourage you maybe through one of the affinity groups. It was fun yesterday. Steve and May going out with you and the group there for our walking group. Yeah, that was fun doing that. And talking to Brian earlier before the service, he was talking about the biking, our next biking group meetup that's going to be happening. And so I'd encourage you in some way, those of you who are watching, to connect with us. Esther, let me read the last couple verses of chapter 2. Esther chapter 2, verse 21. During that time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who were guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. Okay, so Mordecai discovers this plot of assassination, and it says there he's sitting at the king's gate. And I want to put the image up there of the palace, and you see there on the right side is the king's gate, that just outside of the palace. It's a fairly large building. It's 130 feet by 90 feet. It's got four columns in the building, and on the columns in three languages it reads, "Xerxes the king says, by the grace of Arhumazah, the gate Darius, the king made it, he who was my father." So King Xerxes' father built this building, and Mordecai is stationed there as a government employee, and he happens to overhear this plot. Now, we would expect chapter 3 to therefore begin with Mordecai being rewarded for overhearing this plot. I mean, kings back in the day, They were very quick to reward and promote anyone who found out any kind of plot or anything like that, for obvious reasons, right? But instead, take a look, chapter 3, verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. What? Why is Mordecai not being promoted? Instead, this guy, Haman, and it's interesting, the author gives some descriptors. He calls him Haman the Agagite. Everybody say that word, Agagite. Agagite. That refers to his family line. The Agagites were ancient enemies of the Jews. They're descendants of Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites. And so when I read Haman the Agagite, the people, or when the author's writing this, the people are hearing Haman the anti-Semitic. And this Haman has been promoted to prime minister, the second in command behind the powerful King Xerxes himself. Let me keep reading, chapter 3, verse 2. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay honor to him. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. Finally, the cat is out of the bag. After this persisting from his fellow government employees on asking him, why are you not bowing down to Haman? He admits he's a Jew. And this, in a sense, is the tipping point for Mordecai. He's worked his way up in Capitol Hill there to becoming a government staffer, but he cannot bow down before Haman the Agagite. Now, we don't know the reason. We don't know all that's going on in his head. It could be related, you know, purely to him being Jewish. It may be him recalling stories when he was a child of the Ten Commandments and not having any other gods. Haman's garment may have had a Persian idol on it that that Mordecai would refuse to bow down to. But we do know that he's finally, after persistent asking, he's revealed to his co-workers that he's a Jew. And with that declaration, Mordecai is being transformed. In a sense, this is his moment. As everybody else is bowing down before Haman, he's taking his stand. This is his Rosa Parks moment. Rosa Parks, you remember her? The black seamstress in Alabama who refused to get up out of her seat and get to the back of the bus. A moment in history that we remember, a brave and courageous soul. And the same here in Mordecai. We remember his moment. How does Haman react? Chapter 3, verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So this is the launch of the satanic plot to exterminate all of the Jewish people. Haman's not content with just killing the one guy who refuses to bow down. He wants to wipe out an entire race of people. This is a culmination of 10 centuries of hatred that has developed between these people. Verse 7. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month of Nisan, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. So we got there the word pur. We'll come back to that word when we have a Purim being plural for the word pur. We'll have a Purim festival here on June 26 as we wrap up our study of the book of Esther. And we'll enjoy some Haman-tashen together, as the Jews do every year, usually in March that holiday is. And, they read or retell the story of the book of Esther. They hiss when the name of Haman is mentioned. And they also exclaim, "May his name be blotted out." This idea that Haman personifies people throughout the centuries who have tried to wipe out the people of Israel, people like Hitler. Now, the pure are a lot. They these very similar to our dice, the cubes that they would cast. And here in the book of Esther, some court astrologers would, roll the dice in a sense. They would do this privately with Haman, and they would consult their gods. And the idea being that Haman wanted to get the favor of his gods on his plan to exterminate the Jewish people. Verse 8, "Then Haman said to King Xerxes, 'There's a certain people dispersed among the peoples and all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury.' So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. 'Keep the money,' the king said to Haman, 'and do with the people as you please.'" Now, when the king says, "keep the money," he doesn't really mean keep the money, That's kind of like when you go to your aunt's, birthday party and you bring a gift and she says, "well, you shouldn't have brought a gift." Like, she actually doesn't mean that. Like, she was expecting you to bring a gift, When, he says a few things like that in the course of the book. He says to Esther, he says, "oh, my lovely queen, up to half my kingdom is yours." He doesn't mean some of those things when he speaks like that, including this. He desperately wants the money. Haman must be an incredibly wealthy person. Look how much he offers the king, 10,000 talents. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, the annual income of the entire Persian Empire was 15,000 tons of silver. 15,000 talents of silver. So he, in a sense, is offering two-thirds of the income that they would take in a year. Like I said, this guy is incredibly wealthy. No doubt, he's thinking he's going to recoup some of that wealth as he murders the Jewish people and loots their houses and takes their possessions in. The king wants the money because he has just had a disastrous war with the Greeks where he was badly beaten, as I talked about last week with the 300 Spartans. And so he's offering this money. This decree is issued. I read there the king took the ring off of his finger, indicating that he, Haman, can put the seal on this edict. It's an irreversible law that's being put into effect. Verse 12. "Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. They were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods." Now, it's very interesting that Haman begins this procedure in the month of Adar, the very month that the Jews celebrated their deliverance from Egypt. As the astrologers were casting their lots, going by the calendar, month by month, day by day, they arrive at this most precipitous date, the 13th month of the 12th day. And I ask you, church, how is God involved in the rolling of the dice? That day happened to be selected. It's 11 months away, which gives the Jews time to prepare, and it falls on their most holy night. Do you ever think of God being involved in something simple as the rolling of dice? God being involved in the ordinary, everyday things in your life and in mine? Of all the possible dates that the lot could be cast to fall upon, that it falls upon the most revered Jewish holiday, Passover, the day when the Jews celebrate their deliverance from Egypt. They recall the story of the 10 plagues, the angel of death being chased out of Egypt, the water parting, the most celebrated story in the First Testament, and the lot falls upon that day. Isn't that rather ironic? Passover commemorates the deliverance of Israel from Egypt, an event which sort of constitutes their founding as a covenant people. And here, this day of celebration that every year they would look forward to suddenly is being turned in this terrible day of annihilation and destruction, simply because they're Jews. So the author, with having Haman cast the lots through his astrologers, is introducing this concept of destiny into our story. That the word pur that's used there for lot, it's the Hebrew is goral. It's a noun which refers to the cubes, but it also enters this idea of destiny that's used here. We see that word lot used in other scriptures. Psalm 16, verse 5, David writes, "You have assigned me my portion and my cup. You have made my lot," there's the word, "my lot secure. The boundary lands have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance." David there in Psalm 16 is celebrating. He's looking back because Joshua, when he was leading the people of Israel into the promised land, and they were divvying up the land to decide who gets what, they also cast lots to determine who would get what, which area of land. And so David there is reflecting back upon that and recognizing that in the midst of the casting of lots, that God is sovereign. And God is his ultimate inheritance, his ultimate provider. Another example would be Proverbs 16:33. Why don't we stick it up on the screen there, Kelly? Let's read it together. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. There's that same word that's used there in the book of Esther, verse 7 that I read there. That the lot is cast, but God makes the ultimate decision. In the story of Esther, Haman is casting lots to secure a date for the annihilation of the Jews. But ultimately, the author is trying to show us that it was Yahweh, God, who determined how they fell. It wasn't the gods of the Persians that they were consulting. It wasn't the astrologers who were throwing the cubes. Nor was it even chance or luck that it fell upon that day. The God who brought them out of Egypt was still the God involved in their lives. Haman has risen to this power position. He's the prime minister. He's got the king to put this edict out. It's irreversible. But now both Mordecai and Esther are in positions of power. Now, they may not realize that, of course. They don't see the future, what's coming. But even though they have made certain decisions, certain choices, some of which have been good, some of which have not been that necessarily that moral or ethical, but the author's trying to show us this interplay between them making decisions, like I said, good and bad, and circumstances happening, some of which were good and bad. They were thrust upon them. Some of them were their own making. And so you've got their choices together with the circumstances happening, and the author's trying to show God's providence over all of that. That, in a sense, is the mega theme of the book of Esther, God's providence in our lives. Let's pick it up, chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. He went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province in which the edict and the order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. What a transformation for Mordecai, eh? From chapter 2, where it's like, shh, don't cousin Esther tell anybody that we're Jews, to now he's wearing sackcloth and ashes, announcing to the whole city of Susa that he is a Jew, and he's going to be annihilated along with his fellow Jews. And he's, you know, goes right up to the edge there that he's allowed to go to draw attention to himself without, incurring the wrath of the king with a public disturbance order and being assassinated for that. And he's no doubt hoping that his cousin, Queen Esther, will notice him in the sackcloth and ashes. He's previously sent messages to her through her messengers, but there's one big problem. What's the big problem? Nobody knows that she is Jewish. Let's keep reading. Chapter 4, verse 4. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain to her, and he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence and to beg for mercy and to plead with him for her people. Now, Esther is obviously living a fairly privileged and entitled life, that she has no idea that this edict has been issued to her people. Mordecai, as I said, has worked his way up as a government staffer. The fact that he's got a paper copy of this edict indicates to me that he's fairly high up in the government ranks. They didn't have photocopiers, of course, back then, and each one had to be meticulously copied out. And so he hands his copy to Esther's servant to take back to her. Verse 9, Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the peoples of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law. They will be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." So Esther's facing a fairly serious dilemma. Her cousin says, "Hey, go and plead to the king, beg for mercy." But as I mentioned, he doesn't know that she is Jewish. I started out my message by giving some scenarios where you and I would be tempted to remain silent. Esther, no doubt, would have, in this situation, been tempted to remain silent. She's thinking, okay, my cousin wants me to go to the king and plead for mercy, but should I do that? Well, four reasons not to. The king doesn't know I'm Jewish. And maybe now, with this edict, isn't a good time to bring that up. Secondly, it's against the law to go into the king's presence unannounced. Only 7 men were ever allowed to barge in on the king. Their names were in the first chapter that I read last week. They were allowed to barge in on the king at any time, except when he was with a woman. Later on, it's not in the Bible, but they barged in when he was with a woman because he was with one of their wives, and that's when they murdered him. So it's against the law for anybody to go in and see the king, including Queen Esther. Thirdly, it's been 30 days since she's seen the king. He was a real womanizer. He may have moved on from her at this point. Fourthly, I'm wondering, I'm purely speculating, is she thinking about Vashti? And remember what happened to her when she spoke up. Things didn't go so well. There's no doubt that Esther is waffling. Do I go? Do I not go? Do I remain silent? As I said before, she's the only character in the book that has two names. Hadassah, her Hebrew name, and Esther, her Persian name. And one of my commentaries points out that this may refer to her identity crisis. That she's been raised as a Jew, but she's been thrust into the Persian court where she has to live as a pagan. And her character, in a sense, she obeys Mordecai as the Jew, but then she's also has this other life as the queen, as she's found favor with Xerxes. And she's about to become an agent whom God will use to fulfill his promise. So she sends the word back to Mordecai, like, hey, I can't go because of these four reasons that I just mentioned. And then listen to Mordecai's great response. Verse 12. When Esther's words were reported back to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Wow. Isn't that an incredible speech? It's a short speech, but it's been very beautiful. He's basically saying there, hey, cousin, nobody gets a free pass. Just because you're the queen doesn't mean that you'll escape the upcoming genocide. You are not exempt from trouble nor pain. But who knows? Who knows, cousin Esther? But maybe you're queen for such time as this. And how does she respond? Verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Wow. What a transformation for Esther. What a changed Esther in the midst of her wrestling with the idea. Do I go to the king, not go to the king? Do I break the law? What do I do here? She says some beautiful words. If I perish, I perish. That's a transformed Esther. She's gone from, if I go, I perish, to, if I perish, I perish. And there's a world of difference between the two, right? If I go, I perish, suggests hopelessness, no divine plan, fear. Whereas, if I perish, I perish, suggests conviction and courage. Mordecai, her cousin, has also gone this transformation. He went from chapter 2, verse 10, don't tell anyone we're Jewish, to chapter 4, where he's walking around wailing in sackcloth and ashes, telling the whole city he's Jewish, to moving from despair to, hey, you have been put in this palace for such a time as this. And he says particularly some interesting words there. Relief and deliverance will arise. I gotta believe that somehow, even though God's not mentioned there, but this belief in God has been awakened within him. Relief and deliverance. Perhaps, and I'm totally speculating, of course, perhaps it related to the lot being cast and them falling upon Passover. And perhaps behind the casting of the lots, he thought of the providential hand that's at work. I'm wondering if he recalled the story of deliverance that he would have learned as a child, that how his people, after 400 years in slavery, that God raised up a deliverer, Moses, and that they left Egypt. Pharaoh is angry. He decides to chase after them. They're cornered as they've got an angry Pharaoh and his army on one side, and then a sea in front. And then God opened up the sea for 1 million-plus people to walk through. That's an incredible story of relief and deliverance. And though Mordecai has not kept the covenant, and he's been a compromiser, but God has been the covenant keeper. And though the Jews have no army to fight off the Persians in the upcoming genocide, there are no priests, there are no prophets to look to for guidance. There is no temple to go to for worship, but they still had God. And all this other stuff didn't matter because of God. What about you, friends? What about me? Let's change the dialogue from talking about Esther and Mordecai to talking about you and I. Let's take his comment there in verse 14 and let's put it as a question. Why don't we stick it up on the screen there? Does your view of God include God's relief coming and seeing him as your deliverer? Think about that, friends. Think about that in the context and the time period that you and I are living in now. Sheila asked me last week the question, she said, do you have hope for the future? And I got to admit, I had to pause for a second. And then I said, theologically, I have hope for the future. Because Christians are always to be people of hope. But I got to admit, sometimes I look at circumstances and I lose that sense of hope. I think of what the pandemic has done to churches. There are thousands and thousands of mega churches in the United States. A mega church is defined by the Hartford Institute as a church of 2,000 or greater. And there are thousands of them across the United States. Only two of those thousands and thousands of churches have more than 50% people returned to worship services. And that's resulted in all kinds of things, like one of the most famous churches and used to be the largest church, Willow Creek Church, this week laid off a third of their staff in light of those changes. And I wonder, where is God in the midst of the church culture shifting? Where is God in the midst of our post-Christian culture that we live in, that we talked about last week, the cancel culture that we find ourselves in? And I look at things economically. Inflation, the high rate it is now. The high cost of housing here in the Lower Mainland, which greatly troubles me. I had a conversation with the mayor of Surrey this week about that. And I wonder for the future. The pandemic has raised all kinds of questions. Questions about God's sovereignty, as has the recent Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And some of us have asked ourselves a question, is God in control? I think a more important question is, not is God is in control, but rather, is God in control of your life, of my life? A more important question than is God in charge, but rather, is God in charge of you? Is he the Lord of your life? See, the story of the book of the Esther and the story of the Bible is that ultimately God will prevail. The question is, friends, are you and I going to be part of that prevailing team? See, all around us is despair. You ask the average person in the Lower Mainland, and they would tell you something to the effect that it's a beautiful but broken world. And if you're lucky, if the dice roll the right way, you, in a sense, have a good life. but it's broken, and in the end, you die. And that's it. And for the Christian, the world is also beautiful, but broken. However, we are not destined for brokenness. God, our Creator, knows you, created you, knows your story, just like he knew Esther and Mordecai's story. And in your brokenness, he came and died on the cross that you would have life, that he takes our brokenness upon himself. In the words of Mordecai, relief and deliverance will come in this life to a certain extent, and then definitely in the next life. Do you believe that, friends? Do you believe the promises of Scripture, like I put in your outline, Isaiah 43? When you go through the deep waters, I, God, will be with you. When you go through the rivers of difficulty, you will not drown. When you walk through the fire of oppression, you will not be burned up. The flames will not consume you. Friends, have you surrendered to his loving control? Because I believe in the days ahead, if you stand up for God, God will stand with you. Any fans of Where's Waldo? Yeah, anybody like Where's Waldo? Well, let's do a little bit of Where's August. We'll go ahead and take a look at this image here. There's hundreds and hundreds of young men there in that picture. It comes from 1936 in Hamburg, Germany. You've got hundreds of people doing the Heil Hitler salute, of course, and there's one man who's got his arms crossed. You see him? Yeah. Upper right-hand corner there? He's got his arms crossed. His name is August Landmesser, 26 years old. He's not a compromiser. Now, he wasn't always that way. He used to be part of the Nazi party. And, he wore the badge. But then he met a woman, a Jewish woman, fell in love with her, asked for a marriage license. The German party refused. And so he said, no more. No more Heil Hitler. If you're looking for him, whereabouts is he? There he is, right there. Like I said, amongst the hundreds of others who are gathered there as they're dedicating this German vessel, he crosses his arms. What does that look like for you, friends? To cross your arms when everyone else is going a different direction. To be the Rosa Parks, to refuse to stand up when the time is right. Or to be like Esther, to speak up when you know you should speak up. Or to be like Mordecai and refusing to bow when everyone else is bowing. What does conviction look like for you and your family? In your school, in your workplace, among your friends. See, August, he changed. Mordecai and Esther, they changed. You can change also. To be that person of conviction and courage, God will prevail. God is over all. God is writing history. He's asking you, will you be part of his story? Will you be part of this prevailing team? His team. What does conviction and courage look like for you? Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you that you are always at work in our lives. Even when, like Esther and Mordecai, we're unaware of it. That you, as a covenant-keeping God, are still for us. You never turn your back on us. You love us. And you use us. In spite of when we, like them, make poor choices, go down wrong paths, you continue to write your story. a story of redemption, a story of your love. And you as the Lord, thank you. Thank you we can have this assurance and reassurance that you indeed are in control. That even the small things of our life, that even the terrible things of our life, you know when you see them, you're watching over us and you love us and you're working things out according to your plan and your purpose. So draw us as your children to trust you in this and to be men and women of conviction and courage in the times we live in. Amen.